Once more onto the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
And Jeff may be heard to say,
it's Saturday, November 1st.
There you go. So how are you going to start the program?
It's Saturday, November 1st.
Well done.
Which I think is 2014 even, which for us old guys sounds an awful lot like
science fiction.
Science fiction, because it is.
It's a little fictional.
Hey, I got an iPhone 6 Plus. Man, do I like that thing.
I have a Nokia Lumia 1020.
That does not sound anywhere near as sexy.
Man, do I like that thing. It has 41 megapixels on the phone camera.
Well.
I have a very expensive, fancy digital camera with lots of lenses, and it has half that as far as megapixels.
It'd be interesting. Yes. Okay. I'll take your word for that.
Very nice pictures.
Mine shows pictures very well that I take.
Yes.
Yours takes pictures very well that you show.
Yes.
So that's the difference.
Ah. You've just defined the difference between Microsoft phone and Apple's iPhone.
Yeah, one takes them but doesn't show them particularly well, and one shows them but doesn't take them particularly well.
Right. Yes.
So that's okay. I mean, I can't see more than... I actually can't see 41 megapixels. My eyeballs won't work at that level.
You just have to zoom. I can take a picture.
So if I'm moving fast enough, I can see that many pixels?
Yes, if you move very zoomy. No, if you zoom in, I took a picture of a butterfly in flight the other day. And on the picture, it's just a small butterfly and with lots of background. But when I zoom in to that butterfly, I can see the hairs on the butterfly's legs.
Ladies and gentlemen, Jacob likes to see hairs on butterflies.
It's one of those things. I was doing my due diligence because I know a lot of teenage girls go and get tattoos of butterflies on their ankles. I'm checking butterflies for tattoos of teenage girls. Yes.
Very good. That sounds excellent.
I don't think that they keep the practice
going. And the telephone number's in here if you would like to interrupt our silliness and ask us something serious about the economy or investing or something of that nature. 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And I want to lead off this hour by discussing Earl.
Earl as in the black gold?
Yes, the stuff that comes out of the ground.
Texas
and that,
tea?
The fracking black Earl. But we have a caller on 773-1400, and you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Gentlemen, keep getting made.
We work for a living. Go ahead, sir.
Good morning.
A couple observations here, and I concede to maybe some lack of preparation since y'all's earlier discussion just spurred the call. In the discussion about the jobs growth, I think I heard y'all say that we have recovered all the jobs that we lost.
Well, that's a misstatement. I was going to correct him, but I didn't. We recovered the number of jobs.
Yes. So all of the jobs, our workforce has grown in the process.
But as far as a percentage of the population. What we didn't mean to say is that people have filled the same jobs they had before because they didn't.
I'm just saying
that if we have got back to the number of jobs we had before all this started. It sounds to me like you're saying that we're back to where we were 6 or 7 years ago.
Pretty close to that. We're not what we haven't done.
Well, there's some places are back, and some places are far more recovered than they were, far more along than they were, and other places are still way back before what was the great time.
If you have a high level technical skill in the United States today, and high meaning just simply above average, you probably are having a better wage and a better job than you had before. On the other hand, if you are in the lower half of the skilled workforce or unskilled, you probably are not doing as well as you were before.
Right.
Well, the point that it jumps at me is if you're saying, well, let us just say for this discussion that we have the number of jobs that we did 6 or 7 years ago, you picked the term, that doesn't sound like an overwhelming success.
No, it is not an overwhelming. It's a recovery.
Actually, what we've got are job condition as far as layoffs, hires, and if you look at the entire picture, we're back to about 2,000 as far as a percentages are concerned.
Overwhelming success. Yeah. We don't measure success. We measure where we are.
And the issue is, of course, again, that about half of those jobs, and that's a very rough number. Some people say 40%. I mean, there's numbers that float around on this. But about half the positions that are being filled today are held by people who once made more money than they make today in real terms, more money and benefits. So about half the economy about half the people in the economy are working at a lower compensation than they were in 2007. But they're working.
The one other statistic that I missed in your earlier discussion is what is the labor participation rate? Where does that stand historically?
That is a weird one, and it isn't very. And I hate to say this, but there's so many factors that go into that. That it is easily a distorted number. The labor participation rate is down from where it was in 2007. It's down from where it was even in the 1990s. But there's some very good reasons for that.
And let's put some caveats on this particular number, too. Most of the other data that we look at comes from multiple sources. If you've got a survey, then you also have payroll information. If you've got if we're talking unemployment or the jobless rate, those are two ways of looking at the same stuff, and you look at it by looking at different data, so you can put them together and get a pretty good idea. The participation rate comes from a survey, and that makes it hard because it doesn't have a backup to it. We still like to use the number. We still look at it, and it's one of the things we look at when we say, are we fully recovered? The participation rate is not as high as it was before the recession.
And let me tell you the small amount of movement here. Let me give you an example. In 2004, it was up around 66%, which was really quite good.
Yes, very nice.
It's all the way down to 62.7. Like that is not a huge difference. That means that there's 4% smaller group of the adults in the United States participating in the labor force.
But
by the way, the vast majority of that falls into two categories: baby boomers who have retired,
and women
who've decided to use the recession as a good reason to have a child.
Right. So that increases the population with the child, and the woman raising the child, it's typically a woman, but that's not always the case.
I believe I've seen statistics that show on the retirement side of, which I completely concur on, that it increases the number, but an unusually large number of those have been in the early retirement segment.
There are some, unusual is one of those weird words in the economy, in that you have to determine usual. And if you go back to the 1940s, it was unusual to retire. So unusual is one of those things where when we measure things, we have to have something to measure it against. If we've only got, 50 years, economists go, that's not enough data. When we look at retirement rates, yes, a lot of people retired early in the recession, and that's part of it. A lot of people took jobs or didn't take a job immediately after losing a job that was, when they did get a job, was paying less. What we're seeing as far as the recovery is it's still in progress. I would not go so far to say that we are recovered. In fact, when we say the recovery is still going on, when you have a big boom that goes way off into the distance, we're not saying this is recovery, we say this is growth. We're not quite, the GDP has recovered. Austin didn't really have much to recover from. It's way up into growth. Detroit is never going to recover unless we look 50 years.
So I will concede here that my interest may be somewhat prurient on the last point, but I cannot resist the temptation to try to tweak Jeff a little bit.
Tweak.
Let's do it.
Before the last election, Jeff told me, and I think on the radio and others, that after the election, spring would come, and whomever was president would get credit for it. Well, if spring is sprung, the thaw is awful slow.
Yeah, well, this is what we were also talking about. If this were Ronald Reagan or Bill Clinton in office, he'd be taking credit Barack Obama is not very good at talking to people. Most presidents, even George W. Bush, had a tendency to look around and say, look at this, and I have done this, even though the president doesn't have anything to do with what the unemployment rate is. He doesn't, you know, the president doesn't hire those people. But Barack Obama's not taking credit, and
Barack Obama should have a motto above his, where you can see it constantly. We have met the enemy, and he is us.
Yes, absolutely. He has...
He gets in front of... I don't know if you're aware of this, but he and Putin might as well be brothers. He gets with reporters in private circumstances where there's just a few reporters, and he's snarky.
He dictates to them.
And he whines and complains about being mistreated. And as a result, the reporters going on there really come out of these meetings, and I've read these background reports as they come out
it's
of these meetings.
Not very presidential.
And they simply say, what a whiner.
Yeah. We expected him, you know, when we're looking at the campaign, we, like almost anybody else, saw his campaign. Even the Republicans looking at his campaign. I remember Rush Limbaugh and his first campaign. And Rush Limbaugh going, anybody but Hillary, anybody but Hillary, anybody but Hillary.
He got
pretty close to the end of the election, and he was going, whoa, this guy's going to win. Go out and vote for Hillary. And that's what's going on. When you look at his campaign and the way he was rising the feeling and taking credit for things and bringing people together, we thought, oh, man, this guy is going to be he's going to be effective at being president. And then he got into the office, and
he's
an effective campaigner.
Well, gentlemen, I would also say that, yes, you're right. Pogo has been right for a very long time, and enjoy the show.
And you just
for the time.
You just dated yourself that you knew who said that. Pogo Opossum is my favorite philosopher. My second, actually, he's one of my favorite philosophers of the 20th century.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for the call.
And
so back to oil.
Again, telephone numbers in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400. We've got a lot
back
to
oil. But what are you going to say about oil? Because then I want to say something about oil.
Something
exciting about oil. I could come up a conspiracy theory.
I have huge chunks of things to talk about for oil.
We are...
You would think chunks of oil would be coal, but no, we've got informational chunks.
We are doing bad things to Venezuela like mad. At $80 a barrel...
We're actually below that at this point.
That's the break-even point. If the price of oil goes below $80 a barrel, the economists that I read say Venezuela is toast, which is a good deal. They were so strongly anti-American, they will literally bankrupt their country in record time. They're right now having their inflation has risen from 60% to 200%.
Yeah. Wow. That's all?
And... it's just a matter of time till the whole thing blows up in their face. And that, incidentally, when it blows up in their face, that cuts off the literally free oil that they send to Cuba, which keeps them functional.
Yeah. Yep. So let's talk about where that's coming from, because there's multiple aspects to that. One, you were mentioning fracking. The United States is now the largest oil-producing country on the planet again.
Ta-da!
It's been since the 60s, but we did it. We're back. We're getting to energy independence. A lot of that has to do with fracking.
Wait a minute. What happened to peak oil?
It was not peaking at the time.
Oh, it's like Citgo.
Right.
Which belongs to Venezuela.
Right.
If you buy oil from Citgo, you're sending money to a dictator who hates the United States.
So we've got lots of fracking going on. It is bringing the price of oil down significantly. What's more, OPEC is in the middle of a price war with itself. The internal members of OPEC are fighting for market share. So they've lost the consistency of being a dominating force. They produce about 60% of the oil that is produced, so they still make more oil than the United States does by a lot when you add them all together. But the extra oil that's being produced by the United States, generally OPEC would cut back because it wants to keep the oil prices high. Except that Saudi Arabia is looking around, and it's not real happy with Iran.
That's an understatement of
the millennia. And with ISIS going on, Iran is getting more powerful in the area. Iran has national – its troops are in Iraq. We have, for the first time that I'm aware of, we have common cause with Iran in Iraq. We have troops. They have troops in the same place. It's a little bit weird.
The enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Right. And as far as the Saudis are concerned, Iran is Satan in almost every literal sense of the word. So they hate Iran more than they hate the United States, which means that they're our friend, technically speaking, because they don't hate us as much as they hate their enemies. How that works is fun. Anyway, Russia is still producing oil. They can't afford not to. They can't lower the amount that they're producing. In fact, they need as much money as they can get. Their inflation rate is going up through the roof.
And our sanctions are actually hurting them quite badly.
Very much. And the sanctions that they have put on themselves is retaliation, which was
depend on the Russians to say, I'm going to get even with you. Watch me blow my other foot off.
Right. Yeah, I'm going to play Russian roulette. You want to join me? No. Well, then I'll play solitary Russian roulette. Just keep handing the gun back to myself. Anyway, the Russians are not in a good spot right now. The folks at OPEC are getting hurt, but they have lots of oil, so they're not going to be hurt horribly. Venezuela and Iran and Russia are being beaten up, which is... You mentioned Russia is flexing its muscles. Russia is doing some things, and I don't want to leave oil. This is part of oil.
Russia is playing a game, and the game is we are really weak, so we're going to act very aggressively because we're weak, and we don't want anybody to know we're weak. We don't want anybody to know that our economy is collapsing.
It's like a sick dog.
Right.
What does a sick dog do if someone comes threateningly toward them? They're not confident. They are aggressive.
And so Premier Putin, I love that, Premier Putin. It's actually president, but
right.
Premier sounds so much better. Had a little press conference, and he blamed all of Russia's problems on the United States.
Well, in a sense, it's true in that we are producing...
all of them.
Well, in a sense, it is true in that we are producing a lot of oil, and it's causing him to be upset, which is causing the problems
exist. Well, we have these little sanctions, and he...
It has nothing to do with the fact that he invaded a foreign country.
Well, he was saying, look, you guys did it in...
We're doing it in Yugoslavia. We're doing it in Iraq.
We just arbitrarily carved out a piece of what was in Yugoslavia. Wasn't Yugoslavia at that point?
Czech countries that became other countries. Yes.
We just carved out a piece of someplace based on ethnicity and said you can't go there anymore, and set up a separate country. And he said, if you can do that, I can do that. And he says Crimea was perfectly legitimate. He was trying to stop the neo-fascist from enslaving Russians.
Right.
And the reporters were all sitting there going, this guy's out of his ever-loving mind.
Right.
And which is the irony was that he was doing this to a bunch of reporters, and a similar group of reporters, like I said, had sat in on privately with the president
of the United States and said, this guy's out of his ever-loving mind.
What's he whining about?
He's the president.
He's the president of the United States, and he's complaining that the people are not treating him well.
Right. It's kind of like a celebrity that's making $27 million a year going, oh, my life is so horrible. People look at me when I walk in the street.
You know, I said again and again, oh, how I would love to have an effective leader in the White House to unite us. And then I got to thinking about the fact
We probably don't.
Hitler was an extremely effective leader, and he was elected by the German people.
Yeah, I like our checks and balances. It's very nice. Okay, so back to Russia.
Okay.
That's not the only way that they're flexing their muscles. He's saying these things to the reporters, and he's telling them, you know, we're very strong. They're doing the overflights airspace all over the world. They're going back up to massive numbers of airplanes flying around. And when we just mentioned that Germany's having such issues with its military, Russia has a bigger military than Germany by far. And the technology in Russia's military is getting up on newer areas. They, with Sweden, just had a nice little, the hunt for Reds in October in the submarines that were, a submarine was hiding off the coast of Sweden, which is not a part of NATO.
But it popped up in surface for just a little bit in water.
In Swedish water, not very far from the capital of Sweden. That's a problem. That's a very big problem for Sweden. So Sweden's naval fleet is out in force hunting around. They've never been able to find a submarine. But and this goes back to the Cold War. They were never able to locate submarines, but they looked. They looked very hard for a month, and they called off the search. But this is all because the Russians are flexing. Now, several weeks back, I talked about J.P. Morgan Chase and its hacking issue. Someone else was hacked this week, Friday. Are you aware of this?
I'm waiting.
The White House was hacked.
Hmm.
The system that's used by the presidential advisors on at the White House, the unsecure area, which is exactly what was hacked over at J.P. Morgan Chase, the unsecure area, it's basically email addresses and who communicates with whom at what interval, how often they're talking to each other. Which, if you think about the metadata in your phone and people saying, Apple knows where I am, we don't really want the Russians to know who the president's talking to the most, because that leads to other stuff that can happen. So put that all together, Russia is increasing its hacking across the board. It's increasing its military incursions everywhere. And Putin has promised that he will retaliate for the tariffs and sanctions that have been placed on his country. So this is him flexing his muscles, saying, don't mess with us. This is what we can do. It's a problem.
The scary thing is, very frankly, that Russia is very, very sensitive right now about loss of face, just like China has been at various times. And in their weakness, they're flying. Now, this is one of the things that's irony here. I was in the military a long time ago, in military intelligence, among other things. And it wasn't classified then, but the fact is what we were looking at is a certain kind of reconnaissance aircraft / bomber.
The Bear.
That the Russians, the Bears, were using and had been using since the 1960s. These are exactly the aircraft that they're using to penetrate NATO airspace today. They're using 1960s aircraft.
So are we.
To probe.
Our AWACS system is.
No. The AWACS system is on a whole new airframe now.
Oh, did they just replace it?
We still have a few.
Been the last 3 years.
We still have a few B-52 bombers, but we don't use them very often, and we certainly don't use them to
intimidate our neighbors.
To try to intimidate. and the thing is that they're in doing this, there is a danger, and the danger is that, as an example, over the Baltic Sea. Russian Bear bombers at night without navigation lights and without filing, without their transponders on and without filing flight plans.
It's international waters.
Flew very, very close to NATO territory just to see if we'd do anything. And, of course, there was a reaction and the fighters went up. But the point is that flying around in the dark without lights on and a transponder on has a potential. First off, for these aircraft getting lost.
Yeah, that's a big potential.
And secondly, that they could create an incident that results in either in a collision or somebody shooting somebody down.
And then, it's an
and then the Russians
incident.
Would have to do something. The Russians are pushing the edge. And very frankly, they're at a position very much like they were just before Russia fell.
The Soviet Union fell.
Just before the Soviet Union fell, where they it may very well be that their economy is on the verge of collapse, and
that's,
it is.
That's why this is part of the oil discussion, because
The price of oil coming down is hurting them very, very badly.
80% of their government revenue comes from oil.
Mm.
That means that if they're losing profitability in the oil area, and this is something that people have a lot of trouble understanding this aspect. There's a cost to get oil out of the ground. It isn't just people in the government don't get $80 a barrel if the oil is at $80 a barrel. When you get the oil out of the ground, you have to refine it as well. There's a whole series of things that have to be done in order to get it to market. And the profit is what is taxed. If you tax the oil itself, it becomes too expensive to get out of the ground. You have to tax the profit. The profit margins are what's being hit with the price of oil dropping. The Russians don't have easy to get to oil. The Saudis have easy to get to oil. It only costs the Saudis about $10 to get a barrel out of the ground. In South Texas, in the Eagle Ford area, it takes between $40 and $60 to get a barrel out of the ground. Now, you get all this natural gas out as well, which makes it worthwhile, because if you put it all together to equivalent barrels, we're talking about $20 or $30. Now, up in North Dakota, the expansion is going to slow down in the shale area. When we go up to North Dakota, it's more expensive to get it out. The ratios aren't quite as good, which means that we do have a cap on the productivity for shale oil in the United States. But all of that leads to Russia again. It keeps coming back to Russia, Venezuela, Cuba, Iran, these rogue kind of states that are out there.
That are making money off of oil and therefore feel that they can afford to be rogue.
Right, and because they don't depend on other kinds of trade. People want to buy their oil even if they're being really mean to other people, because oil is such a intensely sought-after commodity. Well, it's not so intensely sought after anymore because there's a lot more of it coming out of the United States.
Well, we need to break for some commercials here. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and on the other side, you're certainly welcome to give us a call, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And we'll be back. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. We had a caller during the break, but they gave up on us. So.
I gave up on us years ago.
Yeah, that happens to the best of families. I just wanted to throw in here, in case you weren't listening last hour, we did want to officially congratulate the Mark Stockett.
The Mark Stockett.
Stock market. It broke its, they're really hard on records. They should go to CDs or MP3s or something.
I think it's really hard to break an MP3. You can corrupt it, but breaking it is a lot harder.
And I noticed that when the Dow Jones Industrial Average goes over some magic round figure, everybody gets excited. But when the Dow Jones, but when the S&P 500 breaks through 2000, nobody makes a sound. I thought it was pretty impressive. But for the week, and we'll talk about the S&P 500, up 2.72%, the Dow up 3.48. Year to date, the S&P 500 is up 9.18. The Dow is only up 4.91%. For 1 year, which is getting a little further into what we normally look at, the Dow is up about 11%. The S&P 500 is up about 15%. The NASDAQ is up about 18%. Cool.
Happy news.
Yes, we like that, and we'll see probably more of that the rest of the year. We have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Morning, guys.
Good morning.
I wasn't the one that called during the break, so I'll hang up. I'll make this short.
No, just
call back.
Keep talking.
I just wanted to call and say, y'all often joke and kid about not having any listeners and whatnot like that. Well, I just want to say that for the last 2 or 3 weeks that y'all have been off the air, I've really missed your program. I listened to it as much as I can, and when you're not on, I really do miss it, and I'm glad to see you're back.
Okay,
thank you. We appreciate that.
I've got some questions, but it's going to take some time, so I'll call in next week. I got more time. I'll let you go into this topic if you'd like to discuss the rest of the program.
Don't just throw a question out there.
Really have enjoyed your program, and I do miss it when it's not on, and and okay. I'll keep listening.
Well, I appreciate it. And if you got a question, it might be better than what we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
No, I must rather listen to what y'all have to say.
Okay.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah, but do we want to listen to what we have to say?
Yeah, I don't want to listen. I haven't been listening for a while.
And I just wanted, we talk about the market being up. We talk about the fact that we just had an announcement of 3.5% growth. Now, by the way, when they come out and say 3.5% GDP growth in the third quarter, man, I wish they would explain that. That's taking whatever growth there was and multiplying it, applying compound interest to four quarters.
Yeah.
In other words, if we had the same growth for the whole year that we had in the third quarter, we'd have 3.5% GDP growth for the year.
Yeah.
And in fact, year over year, it was up 2.3%. Man, is it... Statistics are weird. We have another caller on 773-1400. Go ahead. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach.
Morning, Jeff. Morning, Jake.
Good morning. It's been a long time since we've heard this voice.
Yes.
Yes, it has been. Hang on a second. I want to kill the sound. Okay.
Okay.
Oh, that's a good idea with us.
Just tell us to shut up and we'll be quiet.
No, what I was calling about is I was not exactly overjoyed when I noticed that Fannie and Freddie have been reenacted, and I haven't seen anything.
You should open your eyes.
About anything happening with it.
They're probably going to be around for a long time.
Yeah, as sad as that is, what I would like to see happen, at the very minimum, is that they start competing with each other instead of wrapping their hands together behind their backs and saying, oh, yeah, we're different companies.
In effect, mortgages are now more dependent. The mortgage market is now more dependent upon Fannie and Freddie than it ever was before in history.
That's right.
And until we get a complete housing recovery,
there isn't a market for mortgages without them.
Nobody's going to touch right now. If somebody wants to get a mortgage and build a house, or build a house and get a mortgage, or buy a house or whatever, people are so skittish about mortgages that if there is not a government-backed organization to ultimately take the mortgage off their hands,
in the event somebody stops paying on it,
it just ain't going to happen. It's kind of like we've got two or three pieces in our economy, and that's one of them, where if the government were to pull out, it would collapse, and frankly, it would put us back into recession.
Yeah, that there and student loans, because both of those areas need immediate reform that's not going to happen for at least 20 years. So the immediate part of that is going to be delayed and delayed and delayed.
Yeah, I'd say about 20 years from now is when it's going to exactly.
Yeah, so as far as the loaning process for student loans, the reason why we see the kind of rate increase at the colleges is because the money's available, and the money's available there because the government gives loans to people who say they want to go to college. They don't say, well, what do you want to do with what you learn in college? That's irrelevant. They just want you to pay it back.
And very frankly, we got out of the Depression. We went in by borrowing a heck of a lot of money going into World War II.
Yeah.
At the end of World War II, we had, by the way, that's another thing I want to talk about. Our federal debt at the end of World War II was much bigger than it is today in terms of percentage of gross domestic product.
Right, very much so.
Matter of fact, somebody the other day, I noted that our debt relative gross domestic product in the United States is the highest it's been since the 1950s. Woo, big deal. Interesting, but this is the point. Coming out of World War II, anticipating the fact that out of World War I we had a depression, the federal government took some actions under Truman as president. He initiated the actions. Congress supported them to provide two things to the hordes of soldiers who were coming back from the war.
Right.
One was to give them the GI Bill.
Which was an amazing thing.
Send them to college. And number two was to provide in the GI Bill the ability to have a government-backed loan to buy a house with.
Right. Both of those things led to amazingly good things in the economy.
Yes, and so we are kind of saying, if a little of that is good for soldiers coming back from a war, since we drafted everybody who could walk, If we turn around,
some who couldn't.
And some who couldn't. If we turn around and give that to the general population, obviously it will be very good for the economy. And there's a really strong argument that they were right. Because, for example, in the United States, where we have Fannie and Freddie, we are emerging from the Great Recession much faster than either China or Europe, where they don't have Fannie and Freddie.
I would even go even further than China and Europe and say Japan.
Right.
Because Japan, we're still talking about the 1990s when their depression started in the home area.
Yeah.
In order to own a home in Japan, you either have to inherit it or you have to have a large amount of money to go and buy it with cash. You really cannot get a mortgage in Japan.
I want to emphasize something here. The right-wing side of politics beats up on Fannie and Freddie as if somehow they caused the mortgage collapse. No, they did not cause the mortgage.
They were a symptom of it.
They were they out of necessity they tried to participate in the frenzy that went on at the tail end, but it was the investment banks and the insurance and the life insurance companies that generated the craziness that went into the mortgage bond collapse. Yeah. Not Fannie and Freddie. Fannie and Freddie were trailing along at the tail end, and they were both victims. And late participants, but they were not the people who cranked the thing up.
No, they should have. I mean, there's a lot of should haves. Every single bank, Fannie and Freddie, I'm going to include in that category, should have been looking at their bottom line and saying this is going to be detrimental long term. Fannie and Freddie don't have the excuse of a lot of the smaller banks where it's not their risk anymore because you sold the mortgage on, because Fannie and Freddie, they're still accountable.
Well, Lehman Brothers still, they believe their own propaganda.
Oh, yeah, they did, right down into the ground.
But, you know, we could say the same thing about the 1990s when we were looking at the dot-com boom and were saying, man, obviously something great is happening here because the prices are going up.
Or the savings and loan problem.
And if the market says it's good, it must be good, you know. And we were snookered by that to some degree. And the point is that Fannie and Freddie did not cause that.
Here's a great example.
What?
Caller, you probably will identify with this. I'm an artist, and I will go to museums with my wife and friends, and we will look at art. And art is a loose definition
that I don't quite
understand sometimes. I'm looking at it, and people are standing, and they're all looking very thoughtful, and I'm looking thoughtful, trying to control my expression to keep the revulsion off my face. And they all may be, too. Everybody looking at this thing might be trying to keep the revulsion off their face, and because everybody's keeping the revulsion off their face, we're all standing in front of it, and it looks like we're enjoying something that we all hate.
We're all taking it very seriously.
Right, and that group mentality is what happened in the stock market, where the banks were agreeing that this is the way it was because that's the way it was. And prior to Pearl Harbor, in fact, weeks before Pearl Harbor, in Shanghai, in China, there were a lot of American banks there. And those American banks were given the contract to print Chinese currency. And they printed it on old newspaper, which is kind of funny because you could look at the dollar or the
yen.
It wasn't even, each bank had a different name for its currency, which made it very, very strange. The banks on Friday afternoons would send boxes of currencies from their own bank to the other banks because they were all supposed to be backed by silver. And they were trying as hard as they could to dissolve the reserves of silver in the other banks around them. So they would send these huge boxes of money, newspaper reprinted as money, back and forth to each other, and they were all doing it. And what they were really all doing is just exchanging silver in one coffer for another. They were just handing it back and forth because none of them were ever able to get the upper hand until the Japanese arrived and all that silver became part of the Japanese government. So when you look at that, it's a group, you get these little groups that start doing things and then they start saying, well, this is just the way it is. This is art, or this is money, or this is the way you treat money. If you're a bank, you're trying to grab their silver, or you're trying to, it's like a poker game there. And when Fannie and Freddie were doing it, they should have known better, because the long-term implications is part of their charter.
But they were owned by shareholders.
Right.
So did you have any bonds or listener? Did you have any?
I still am a shareholder.
So that's the point. The shareholders wanted dividends, and they wanted to see the share price go up, and they demanded
Of course.
And even if it meant wrecking the economy, they were perfectly willing to see the share price go up.
Well, what happened wasn't necessarily as bad on the economy as it was for the shareholder of Fannie and Freddie.
Yeah.
That tends to be what happens.
And that, by the way, when people complain that people didn't go to prison in the investment banks.
Well, the investment banks, the best way to punish them is to take their money away.
And that's what happened. And by the way, as I've said to a lot of people, they didn't break any laws.
Right.
Why do you want to send somebody to prison who didn't break a law?
They were stupid, but if you punished everybody for being stupid, we'd all be in prison.
Yeah, I guess there's something to that.
But the issue is, what have we learned from this? And I think what we've learned from this is very important, and that is, if we leave a large section of the economy where money is being traded, because money is an intangible, where intangibles are being traded, or there's no cause and effect relationship directly between the person who does the initial purchase and the person who uses it, you know, the person taking the mortgage.
Let's use person of the first part and party of the second part.
Well, the mortgage banker, as they call themselves, the loan makers, would unload it to, you know, something like Countrywide, and Countrywide would immediately unload it to another bank, and they would immediately unload it. So there was no connection between the people who wound up with the bonds and the people who the money was loaned.
Risk disassociation.
So, and it's just like with it's just basically like with beef. And I've said this before. When I was a kid, I would go across from my grandmother's house. I'd walk across the railroad tracks over to a butcher shop, and I would buy cuts of meat for our home so we could eat. And the butcher, who universally was named T-Bone, knew the farmer from whom he got the cattle. So there was a...
He may have even known the cow's name.
There was a responsive connection all the way from the person who owned the cow to the person who's eating. Once that was broken, and we, of course, that's why the price of food has come down so tremendously, is we went to mass production. We'd have no clue when we go to the grocery store where that cow was, or if that cow was sick or not sick, and there's no way. The grocery store has no clue where the meat came from.
The people that did the butchering didn't even know.
So then we have to have the USDA. We have to have federal regulation for interstate commerce.
Yeah, when you have an intangible where you don't know where it's from, if you don't regulate it, then you get fraud. It just happens.
And there was a decision made in the 1990s in the interest of right-wing idealism, amazingly, as many Democrats supported it as Republicans, to not regulate the derivatives market. And the mortgage bonds were being sold on the derivatives market, thinking that the markets were self-correcting, markets would take care of themselves, and they don't.
If that were the case, we would never have market crashes.
Right. So the question is, and I'll just tell you, this is my little soapbox, I don't think anything's going to change. We came out of this with one major financial institution still unregulated at the federal level that does interstate and international commerce on a financial basis. It is the arguably the largest one doing it. Do you know what it is? Listen, do you know what it is? I mean, there's a...
Most people don't. Arguably most people don't even have an idea.
The largest holder of financial assets in the world.
You're talking about...
life insurance companies that sell annuities.
Oh, it's a life insurance company?
No, not a life insurance company. The industry of life insurance companies is regulated at the state level by... And each state is regulated according to its own very narrow interests. AIG was the cornerstone of the collapse. And AIG was regulated only by the insurance commissioner's office of the state of New York, despite the fact it was the largest global player in the bond market.
Yeah.
So, and the SEC had no authority over it. The Federal Reserve had no authority over it.
This is why the Federal Reserve was involved in the bailout, if you can put it that way, because AIG wound up paying a lot of money for the bailout. The Federal Reserve at the New York Bank, not at the Federal Reserve federal area. It was the New York head, Tim Geithner, who negotiated with AIG to keep that collapse from going any further.
And so we still have the life insurance industry not regulated at the federal level. So I can tell you from history, there's
it's
a high probability
again.
The life insurance industry will take us into the next crash. But we got to do commercials.
Yes. Thank you very much for the call. It's good
right.
to hear your
Thank
voice.
Thank you, guys.
Take care. Bye-bye. And you are listening to Personal Wealth Coach, but we're going to do some commercials. Anyway, you listen to this stuff, and we'll be back on the other side.
If you
And we're back with another few minutes of the Personal Wealth Coach, and we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. Hello.
You're on the air.
Yes, I'm on the air.
You yeah. are.
Okay, this is Bill from Temple.
Hi, Bill.
I heard that this may be the last year for earned income tax credit, and I was wondering if y'all know anything about that, if they're changing something around.
I find it very highly unlikely that the earned income tax credit's going to go away.
Yeah, I can't.
It's a normal thing in an election cycle to make it part of the deal, but basically if even a Republican came in and said, I'm going to get rid of the earned income thing, yeah.
That would make sure we got a Democratic president.
Yeah. unless
Guaranteed.
Unless we completely revise the whole system, the earned income tax credit and the mortgage interest tax deduction are two things that are so sacred that it's the You don't touch it. For a politician, it's like saying, I'm going to stop Social Security.
That would be equivalent a massive increase in taxation on poor people with children who are working.
Appreciate you clearing that up.
Okay.
I was a little worried about that.
Well, it's something worth worrying about, and the Republicans in the House are making noises about wanting to end it, but
it's not going to happen.
It would just...
One of the most brilliant
political
things,
suicide.
Yeah, one of the most brilliant things that the Democrats ever did is they converted a big chunk of welfare into tax credits because Republicans love tax credits.
And
the Republican that goes up and says, I'm going to get rid of a tax credit, it sounds like they're raising taxes.
And the issue is that you don't get that form of welfare unless you're working. If you're not working, you don't get earned income tax credit because it's earned income tax credits.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so basically it says if you're working but you're not making very much money, we will pay you, but if you stop working, we won't.
Which is a pretty good system.
And I like that system personally,
it's a good safety net.
Even though Mitt Romney campaigned against it. All right, thanks for calling.
Yep, and we're about out of time. If you would like to contact us off the air, generally during the week we have a phone number that in office hours has actual live people answering the phone. But during non-office hours, which includes today, you can reach voicemail locally at
947-1111. That's 947-1111. They did it so I could remember it.
You can also reach it toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us directly at Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can contact us through there. You can listen to podcast. Until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
ATM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood. Proud to broadcast to the largest military post in the free world. News Radio 1400 KTEM. Fox News.